You are listening to the Apria Leadership Podcast Series with Mark Cooper, recorded during the Apria Asia Pacific Property Leader Summit in Shanghai, in conversation with Alan Miyasaki, Senior Managing Director at Blackstone Group.
This is the Apria Leadership Podcast Series with Mark Cooper. I'm here with Alan Miyasaki, Senior Managing Director at Blackstone Group. Welcome, Alan. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark. Great to be here.
You've been with Blackstone. I did a quick bit of research for on the web about you since 2001 and since in Asia since 2007. It'd be interesting to hear a little bit about how your career has developed and kind of tie that in with how Blackstone's Asia-Pacific business has grown over the same time. What have been the big milestones for you personally and for the firm?
No, it's been a great career, and I've really enjoyed working at Blackstone. So I first started in New York, working our U.S. business. And it's interesting, that really, the U.S. business is where Blackstone really started in real estate. And it wasn't until around the late 90s that Blackstone moved and really opened their office in Europe. And it wasn't until Chris Hetty, who's my partner, and I moved out to Asia in 07, that we really started our Asia franchise. So coincidentally, when we moved out, it was interesting. I spent a lot of time, you know, educating people on what Blackstone was and what our business was, but it was actually very helpful that it was also the same time that Blackstone went public. So as a public company, we got a lot of publicity, and that helped, I think, in terms of educating people on Blackstone and the background of our firm. Obviously, it was a very tough time to start a real estate business in Asia, coming in right as the financial crisis hit. And I think our business grew a little differently than it would have elsewhere in the world. One of the first things, big things we did in 2010 was took over the management of Merrill Lynch's Real Estate Opportunity Fund.
Of course.
And, you know, it was probably one of those rare situations where we became an asset manager before we started doing acquisitions. And so that really helped us in terms of a lot of the more opaque markets in Asia really get feet on the ground, really understand the markets, really understand, you know, how things worked, and gave us a lot more experience, which was very, very helpful than when we, and helped us when we started actually investing capital. Since then, you know, we've expanded, so we have offices across Asia, in Australia and India, and two in China, Japan and Singapore and Hong Kong. So the business has really grown, and the nice thing is we now have multiple different sources of capital. So we have an opportunistic strategy, we have a core plus strategy. So it's really been nice to see that the business perform and grow in a nice way.
Yeah, that the core plus strategy is an interesting one because it's fairly new but has grown quickly. So clearly there's a lot of demand for it out there. But people would probably argue it's difficult to do in Asia. So how's that worked for you?
Well, I think that, you know, generally everything's difficult, but the core plus is no exception. And I think that it's really been nice because it's hit a different pocket of demand in terms of people that want a little bit less risk. They want higher quality assets. And so we think it's really been a great product for them. And it also focuses a little bit more on current cash flow. So that's been really, really helpful.
And I suppose going back to things that are tricky, you've been involved with Blackstone's transactions side of the business in Asia Pac. And everyone says that transactions are hard to find these days. How do you make it easier? And do you think it is actually any harder today than it was 2 years ago or 4 years ago?
Well, I'm a deal guy, so we have very short memories. And we always look at it and say, oh, last year was super easy. This year is really tough. And the reality is when we're going through it, last year didn't feel so easy either. I think that it's always challenging. I think if you want to create alpha and create good value and think about things differently, that's always a challenge. It's always trying to find something a little different, find an angle, find an asset where there is an opportunity to create value in a different way than just taking market risk. So I think it's always a situation where you have to work a little harder. But I think that the way we look at it today may be a little different as the cycle has evolved. You know, when you, in the bottom of the cycle, you may have been buying non-performing loans, which are challenging in a different way than going and buying assets. But today, you know, we're buying assets, but there's got to be some angle to them. There's a mark-to-market opportunity. There's a renovation opportunity. There's some work to be done to create value in asset management, because it's hard to believe that, you know, just because the market's there, it'll rise because we bought an asset. So a lot of it's more on how can we create value and how can we do something to improve the performance of the asset.
Now, you talk about where we are in the cycle. There's been a lot of talk over the past 2 or 3 years about how far we're near the top, what's going to happen in the future. And there was an interesting point made in one of the conference sessions this morning that there's no point in trying to predict whether the next downturn is going to be in December or in 18 months' time. But what you probably know as a real estate investor is that at some time over the life of the assets, or the life in your fund of the assets that you're buying today, something is going to change. So how is Blackstone insulating itself against that change?
Yeah, I think we're doing a couple things. And, you know, it's really, you're 100% right. It's very hard to pick the exact moment when you're at the bottom or at the top. If we could all do that, we'd do that once a cycle and we would be on vacation the rest of the time. But it's not that easy, obviously. So I think what we do is, you know, I think we're really thoughtful about how we invest and where we invest. So I think today, you know, we look for markets where we look for higher quality assets. And the way I think about higher quality assets is not, does not mean they're shinier. It means that they're in markets or high quality assets that are always liquid. So, you know, if you were in, for example, Sydney, at the bottom of the financial crisis, you could always sell a billion in Sydney.
Yeah.
But if you were in a second or third tier market, you may not have a buyer. And I think that, you know, even when things went down, when they recovered, the first tier higher quality assets were the first ones to recover. So I think that, you know, you do things like make sure you have a long maturity on your debt. You look at, you know, locking in tenants. You look at making sure you have a strong cash on cash in your assets and making sure you have assets that will stand the test of time. That, you know, when the markets are open or when they're more difficult, there's always somebody who wants to buy and there's always demand, because even if there is a downturn, they will recover first. So I think that the way you look at what you invest in may change a little bit.
Okay, maybe we can talk about a few markets and a few sectors around the Asia Pacific region that look interesting to Blackstone at the moment. You don't need to kind of cover everything, but perhaps consider two or three sector and city or country combinations that seem good opportunities right now.
You know, we've been for a long time now very big buyers of India, and we're today one of the larger owners of office buildings as well as retail malls. And I think that's really been a play on the fact that we're seeing a resurgence in the growth in India, and it's not just domestic Indian demand. If you look at our office portfolio, a lot of it's been foreign companies. And it's interesting, if you think about the downturn in the U.S. and the financial crisis, a lot of companies moved jobs to India because it was more affordable. But if you talk to those same companies today, their challenge is they can't find enough engineers. They can't find enough educated college graduates. With unemployment, you know, 3%, it's very difficult to fill those positions in their home country.
Yeah.
So they're increasingly looking to India as a place where they've had a good experience. They have high quality employees and they're growing their presence there. So it's amazing when you think about office buildings, and we talk with our asset manager teams, and at any given time they're talking about multiple million plus square foot leases. Usually you only hear that when it comes to warehouses.
Yeah.
But the idea that you have that in office really shows you how much growth is going on there and how much you know, the demand for high quality, thoughtful, smart employees. There just aren't enough of them around the world to meet the growth characteristics of some of these companies. And so they're increasingly looking to India to get those high-quality graduates.
And I guess it's still early days for the Indian real estate market as well in terms of institutionality. And
absolutely. I think, you know, we were very involved and we're a big investor in India's first REIT. So that's been, I think, a maturation process for the Indian market. And I think that that's a good example of how that market has become more institutionalized. You're seeing more institutional investors globally spend time in India. So I think it's a very good thing overall for the market.
Okay. And where else? I mean, maybe you could talk a little bit about China as we're here today.
Yes, we really enjoy investing in China. We've done a lot of logistics here in China. So I think that one thing that we like to do is we look at macro trends and take it from the macro to the micro. So, you know, if you look at some of the trends here, and I think one of the speakers this morning was talking about the growth of domestic consumption in China.
Yep.
And that in China we're about the same, almost same level as the U.S. in terms of total domestic consumption. So if you think about that, and you think about the number of warehouses or high quality grade A warehouses that are in supply in China, there's a massive mismatch. So we looked at that and said, you have growing domestic consumption, you have not enough warehouses. That's probably going to lead to a supply-demand imbalance, which means if you build new warehouses, they'll lease up and rents will probably go up as well. And so that's a thesis we've fundamentally been investing in for the last couple of years. I'd say we've invested in that thesis around the world, but specifically in China, the demand characteristics here have been exceptional. And we've really been, I'd say in general, very surprised by if you build anything we've built in tier one cities has leased up faster than we would have expected.
And logistics seems to be everybody's favorite sector. And like you say, around the world, not just China. Are you invested in elsewhere in Asia Pacific?
So we have logistics, a lot of places. We've invested in logistics in Japan, in Korea, in China, and in Australia. So we do have a relatively large portfolio across a Pan-Asia portfolio. But I think for Blackstone, if you look at high conviction investment themes, logistics has been one of the biggest ones globally. I think the other one that's been a very big high conviction theme for us globally has been multifamily rental housing,
yep.
So residential. Obviously in Asia Pacific, the biggest market for that where it's the most liquid is probably Japan, and we've been very active there. But we increasingly look at other markets where the build to rent or the rental model is still evolving, but we think that long term that will be a very big market in Asia as it is in the US and Europe.
Yes, I mean, I think some of the predictions for how multifamily will grow in Asia are quite remarkable because of the pace of urbanization and, of course, the sheer number of people in this region as well.
And the reality is my parents didn't want me living with them for very long, so they were very keen to have me move and get my own apartment. So I think that's probably more of a universal trend than just a my family dynamic.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, talking about sectors, I've got you down as maybe something of an outlier in that Blackstone has bought quite a lot of Asia retail over the past couple of years. And many people, somebody again mentioned at the conference this morning, the phrase retail apocalypse. It's a sector that's come under a lot of pressure globally. So why do you like it in the markets that you've bought it in Asia?
I think that there is a little bit of a scenario where everybody says retail's bad globally and they kind of close their minds to it. And I think if you look at retail in different areas, it's a little bit different. So if you look at America, where we have a B mall that's anchored by a Sears and a JCPenney, that's a pretty challenging asset, especially when you have more retail square footage per capita than just about anywhere else in the world. If you went to Australia, it's half that. If you go to China or Hong Kong or India, it decreases even more. I mean, the reality is, if you're in India, there aren't a lot of alternatives. You have to go shop on the high street. And let me tell you, when it's 40 degrees out and it's raining in the monsoon season, shopping on the high street's not a wonderful experience. Going to a air-conditioned, high-quality mall with a great food and beverage offering and a movie theater all of a sudden sounds like a great alternative for a family on a Saturday or Sunday. So I think what happens is we've really focused on places that can be community centers and also really focus on not just apparel and clothing, but a lot on non-discretionary as well. So mm-hmm. If you went to Australia or actually any of our malls, they're all grocery anchored. So they have a reason for people to come multiple times a week to get their groceries. They may have a little farmer's market. They have a lot more restaurants and activities for families. So the idea for us is to think about the mall a little bit differently. I think that the reality is people will continue to buy goods for a long time. They may buy more online. So you have to have a differentiated offer in a mall. And I think the fact that everybody said, it's just bad, I can't touch it, that's created an opportunity. If you have a high quality asset in a great location that's differentiated by being more non-discretionary, that can be an interesting alternative today.
Do you think there's an argument that Asia does retail, or at least malls, better than, say, the US or Europe, in the sense that here they are more likely to have already been a community-focused asset and probably already had more F&B and had more shared spaces, more kind of human elements to them?
I think you've seen that. In part, it's just there was a little more scarcity value. We don't have as much to begin with.
Yeah.
And in general, people live in smaller homes in Asia because we have bigger, denser populations than we have in the U.S. So the idea of in the U.S., you live in your house in the suburbs, you get in your big SUV, you drive to a mall, that's a very different experience than going downstairs to get your groceries. And I think that these denser populations, if you go to Hong Kong, if you look at the average square meters per unit in terms of housing, for a lot of people, you don't have people over to your apartment to have dinner. What you do is you go to your apartment complex and you go to a restaurant in the complex because you can't entertain 5 people or 10 people in your unit.
Yeah.
So I think that's a difference which you would not necessarily see in the U.S. So it's a little different vibrancy around the retail. And the impact of how much of a business is more non-discretionary than we see elsewhere.
Okay. Something else we heard this morning was about the niche sectors in everything becoming less alternative. And obviously there's a lot of interest in niche sectors in real estate, such as student housing, self-storage. Are there any of those in this region that you find particularly interesting?
Yeah, we do look at a lot of these things. I do think that, you know, if you look at currently, we're probably a little more focused on, I always call it the main food group. So it's, you know, industrial, it's residential, it's office, and really focused on location because, you know, at the end of the day, our business is location, location, location. And so if you look at some of these niche groups, I think we're open-minded to that, but we're really focused on where they're located. So if you go and have student housing in, you know, a central location next to university, that's different than somewhere in a more, in a place where it's a more suburban area or it's further away from a university and they're much more open new supply. So I think that it's just a location issue for us.
Okay, it's not so much the niche and the ability to find those extra returns in them.
Well, I think that, you know, what happens, I think, a lot of times later in the cycle is people look at sectors where they can get an extra 25 bips or 50 bips of yield. And the question is, if you're going to go to a different sector, is there, what's the risk you're taking on liquidity and otherwise for being in that sector? I mean, the same thing we said about development, right? You know, if you go and you're developing a building versus buying an existing building, if you're doing that for an extra 400 basis points, that may be priced appropriately. If you're doing it for 10 basis points, it may not be worth the risk. So I think a lot of it's really kind of pricing risk appropriately. I mean, people always ask me what I do for a living, and I always say I do real estate or I do property. But the reality is, as an investor, our job is to price risk. And it's trying to figure out, you know, what the yield premium is and how that compares to what the risk premium is.
Okay, fantastic. That's great. Thanks very much, Alan.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you for tuning in to the Aprea Leadership Podcast Series. Hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. We'll be back soon with more. If you like what you heard and would like to give us feedback on future podcast episodes, please contact Sigrid Jalcita, that's SIGRID.ZIALCITA@aprea.asia.